The hyena road led Robin and her little party into the mountains, into the mist and the strangely desolate valleys of heather and fantastically shaped grey stone. It led her to the slave stockades which Juba had described to her, the meeting place where the white man and black man made their trade for human life, where the slaves exchanged their carved yokes for cuff and chains. But now the stockades were deserted, the thatch already sagging and falling in untidy clumps. Only the sour smell of captivity lingered, and the swarming vermin that infected the empty buildings. In a futile gesture, Robin put fire to the buildings. From the misty mountains the road led on, down through dark gorges, and at last to the low littoral, where once more the heat clamped down upon them from a sullen, overcast sky, and the grotesque baobab trees lifted their twisted, arthritic branches to it, like crippled worshippers at a healing shrine. The rains caught them, here, upon the coastal plain. The flood swept three men away at a ford. Four more, including one of the Hottentots, died of fever, and Robin herself was smitten with the first onslaught of the disease. Shivering, half-demented by the phantoms of malaria, she toiled on along the rapidly overgrown trail, slipping and stumbling in the mud and cursing the fever miasma that rose from the brimming swamps and hung like a silver wraith in the sickly green glades of fever trees through which they hurried. Fever and the rigours of the last stage of the journey had tired and weakened them all. They knew that they were, at the most, only a few days' march from the coast, deep into Portuguese territory, and therefore under the protection of a Christian king and a government of civilized men. It was for these reasons that the Hottentot sentry slept beside the smouldering watch-fire of damp wood, and it was there that they died, their throats slit, with a blade sharp enough to cut off the least cry. So Robin woke to rough hands upon her, twisting her arms up between her shoulder blades and a bony knee in the small of her back, while steel cuffs clicked coldly about her wrists. Then the hands released her, and she was wrenched cruelly to her feet and dragged from the leaky hut beside the hyena road. The previous evening she had been too tired and feverish to undress, so now she was still clad in a stained and rumpled flannel shirt and patched moleskin breeches. She had even kept the cloth cap on her head, covering her hair. Thus, in the darkness, her captors did not realize that she was a woman. She was bound with her own porters and Hottentots, forced to wear the light marching chains, which were proof, if proof were needed, as to who her captors were. The dawn revealed them to be half-breeds and blacks, all of them dressed in the cast-off finery of European style, but carrying modern weapons. These were the men she had crossed half a continent to meet, but now she cowered in the rags that were her only disguise. She shuddered to think of her fate, if they should discover her sex, and she berated herself for having so blithely believed that she and her entourage would be safe from these predators merely because she was white and English. Their prey was human flesh, of whatever colour and condition, and that was all she was now, human flesh on the hoof. A chained creature, of little real value, a few dollars on the auction block, and she knew that her captors would think nothing of taking their pleasure upon her, or of leaving her beside the road with a ball through the temple if she provoked them in any way. She kept silent and obeyed instantly the least word or gesture from her captors, slipping and dragging in the mud. They were marched on eastwards, forced to carry their remaining stores and equipment, which had now become slavers' booty. They were closer to the coast than Robin had calculated. They smelt the iodine and salt of the sea from afar. And later, as night began to fall, they caught the smell of wood smoke and the unmistakable odour of captive humanity. Then at last they saw the firelight flickering in the darkness ahead and the awful loom of the barracoons. Their captors marched between the dark stockades of pole and daubed mud, from which the chilling dirge rose of men without hope, singing of a land they would never see again. At last they came into the central square around which the barracoons were built. It was an open area of trampled mud, where a raised platform of rough sawn planks had been built. Its purpose was immediately clear. For the first of Robin's servants, was dragged up the steps and stood upon the platform, while the fires around the clearing were heaped with dry wood to light the scene. The platform was the auction block, and it seemed that the sale was about to take place. The auctioneer was clearly of pure Portuguese stock. A little man with the wrinkled, sun-browned face of a vicious gnome, he had the bland smile and the unblinking eyes of a serpent. He was dressed in elegantly cut jacket and breeches, and his boots and belt were of the finest Iberian leather, ornately tooled and with solid silver buckles. He carried a pair of expensive pistols in his belt, and wore the wide-brimmed, flat-crowned hat of a Portuguese gentleman upon his small, wrinkled head. Before climbing up on the block, he sent one of his personal slaves with a casual kick and cuff to the carved wooden drum at the edge of the clearing. On it the slave began pounding out a summons to the buyers. The slave went to it lustily, his bare torso gleaming with sweat and raindrops in the firelight. And in answer to the urgent staccato rhythm of the drum, men came from out of the shadows of the grove and from the living huts between the barracoons. Some of them had been drinking. They came arm in arm, brandishing their rum bottles and bellowing in drunken chorus. Others came singly and silently, but they came from every direction and gathered in a circle about the auction block. The men who formed the circle seemed to be from every hue that the human skin is capable of assuming, from purple-black through all the shades of brown and yellow to dead shark's belly white, and their features were African and Arabic, Asian and European. Even their dress differed widely, from the flowing robes of Arabia to the faded finery of embroidered jackets and high boots. They had only one thing in common, the hawk-fierce eyes and merciless mien of those who deal in human misery. One at a time, Robin's servants were prodded up onto the block, and their ragged clothing was ripped away to expose their physique to the buyers. One of these might come forward to feel the muscle tone, or force open a slave's mouth to examine the teeth, like a gypsy horse dealer at the fair. Then, when the buyers had satisfied themselves as to the quality of the wares on offer, the small Portuguese would step lightly to the front of the block and begin the bidding. The men in the circle below him called him Alphonse, and though they exchanged coarse banter with him, yet they all treated him with wary respect. There could be no clearer proof of the man's reputation than fear and respect from these men. Under his control, the sale went swiftly. The Hottentots, small, wiry men, butter-yellow and with flat, pug-like features, attracted little interest from the circle of buyers, knocked down for a few silver rupees apiece, while the porters, taller men and well-muscled, from many months of hard marching and porterage, fetched better prices, until they came to old Karanga, ancient and toothless, hobbling onto the block on stalk-like legs, seeming barely able to support the weight of his chains. The laughter was derisive, and the little Portuguese pleaded in vain for a single bid before dismissing the old man with disgust. It was only when he was hauled down off the block and dragged away into the darkness beyond the fires that Robin realized what was about to happen to him, and forgetting her resolve not to draw attention to herself, "No! Let him go!" Hardly one of them glanced in her direction, and the man who held her chain hit her a careless open-handed blow across the side of her face that blinded her for a moment. She dropped to her knees in the mud, and through the buzzing in her ears heard the thud of a pistol shot from the darkness. She began quietly to weep, and still weeping she was hoisted to her feet, and in her turn dragged forward into the circle of firelight and hoisted by her chin onto the block. "A young skinny one," said the Portuguese, "but white enough to make a choice bum boy for the harems of Omani. Once he has had his knackers clipped, who will give me 10 rupees? "Let's have a look at him," a voice shouted from the circle, and the Portuguese turned to Robin, hooked a finger into the top button of her flannel shirt, and ripped it down to the level of her belt buckle. She doubled over, trying to conceal her upper body, but the man behind her twisted the chain and forced her upright. Her breasts pushed out pertly through the torn shirt, and the ring of watchers growled and moved restlessly, the mood changing instantly. Alphonse touched the butt of one of the pistols in his belt significantly, and the growl of comment died. The ring of men drew back a little. 10 rupees? Alphonse Pereira asked. From across the circle, a powerfully built man swaggered into the firelight. Robin recognized him instantly. He wore a tall beaver hat, tilted back on his head, and from under the brim curled thick, shiny black hair. His teeth, when he opened his mouth, sparkled in the light of the flames. His face was flushed with excitement. His voice was thick with it. Gold! He shouted. Heil bid gold! A gold mohur of the East India Company, and a plague on any of you that goes above that. A gold mohur, called Alphonse, the slave master. A gold mohur, bid for my brother Camacho Pereira, and good luck to him, he chuckled. Come now, who wants to deny my brother Camacho a fair tap at the wench? One of his men slapped Camacho's back. Sweet Christ, you always were a hot one. At that price you can have my turn on top of her. And Camacho laughed delightedly and came to the front of the block to stare up at Robin. Tipping the beaver hat forward, he whispered, I have had to wait a long time. Robin felt the little insects of loathing crawling over her skin, and she backed away to the limit of her chain. Come now, Alphonse called. Who will go beyond a gold mohair for a fine piece? She is mine. Camacho told his brother. Strike the bargain. His brother lifted his hand to knock down the sail when another voice stopped him. A double eagle, sir. 20 golden dollars American bid. The voice was not raised, yet it carried clearly to every man there, as it could carry from quarterdeck to maintop in a force 8 gale. Robin started and swung her chains disbelievingly in that direction. She would have known that lazy, drawling inflection if she had not heard it for a lifetime. It stood at the very edge of the firelight, but as every head in the circle turned to him, he stepped forward. A smile had frozen on Alphonse's face, and he hesitated. Call the bid! The advancing figure in plain white shirt and dark breeches made the men about him seem small and grubby, and after a moment's hesitation, Alphonse obeyed him. A double eagle bid, he said harshly. Captain Mungo St. John of the Clipper Huron bids a double golden eagle. Robin felt her legs start to sag under her with relief. But the men behind her jerked her upright by her chain. Camacho Pereira had whirled to face the American and to stare at him furiously. Mungo St. John answered him with a smile, indulgent and patronizing. Robin had never seen him look more handsome and dangerous. His dark wavy hair catching the firelight, and the gaze of his yellow-flecked eyes level and unflinching in the face of Camacho's fury. 1,000 rupees, Camacho, he said softly. Can you match it? Camacho hesitated, and then turned back quickly to his own brother, his voice low and urgent. Stake me, he asked, and Alphonse laughed. I never lend money. To a brother? Camacho insisted. Especially not to a brother, Alphonse answered. Let the wench go. You can buy a dozen better for 50 rupees each. I must have her. He whirled back to face Mungo St. John. I must have her. It is a matter of honor. Do you understand? He took the beaver from his head and spun it away. One of his men caught it, and Camacho ran both hands through his thick black locks, and then stretched his arms down at his sides, flexing the fingers like a conjurer about to perform a sleight of hand. I will make one more bid, he said ominously. I bid 1 mohair of gold and 10 inches of Toledo steel. The knife seemed to appear in his hand from out of the air. He lifted the point to the level of Mungo St. John's belt buckle. Hawk away, Yankee, or I will take the woman and your gold double eagle. The watchers growled, a low, bloodthirsty sound, and swiftly rearranged themselves into a ring about the two men, jostling for a better view. 100 rupees says Machito slits the Yankee's guts.
Done.
And there was a rising hubbub as the wagers were called and accepted.